Hey, yo, and here we go. It's WTC, episode number 47. We Talk Comics occupies Frank Miller. Basically, this is a very special episode. This week, we won't have any news. Of course, you can always get the news at our proud show sponsor, Comicosity, where you get all the news that we won't be giving you. And we won't have any reviews either. Because what we're going to be doing is we're going to be covering the life and times of Frank Miller as best we can from top to bottom, looking at his work within sequential art. And a little bit maybe in some of the other stuff that he's done as well. But that's this week. This week we're not really having four hosts as so much as me, Mo. I'm the host. And the other three guys are the panelists. They're going to be the ones who are giving you the insight into Frank Miller. And, of course, that's our regular guys here. Brett, how are you doing?
Oh, so far so good.
And Chris, how are you?
I'm awesome. I'm excited for this episode, actually. I love Frank Miller.
Yeah, no, this is going to be a lot of fun. Keith, how are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling out of my element without the news and without so many other things that I love about this show. Like, you know, Frank Miller's never worked on Booster Gold, for example. I have no idea what to talk about.
Yeah.
There it is, folks. There it is.
You still managed to get the Booster Gold reference in, you bastard.
What's anyway, that, like 40 seconds in? I think we need to start like a pool on how
over,
fast
under pool.
He can get it in.
Oh, man. All right, well, we're going to talk Frank Miller, as I say. Frank Miller, one of the most interesting, controversial, and important creators in the history of comic books. And we're going to open this one up. I'm going to throw out to you guys. And I'm going to throw up to Brett the first one here. And we're going to talk about probably his work that I think that he is best known for within the public consciousness. And that's not so much within the comic book community, because I think they have a different view on Frank Miller, but within the mainstream. And that would be Sin City. Brett, so let's open up with your thoughts on Sin City.
I remember when Sin City first came out, and I especially remember the art. Because I thought the art was such a departure from the usual art style that you would see in most any comic. And it was just so dark, and the characters were just so, you know, on that cusp of being good, but also on the cusp of being kind of bad. And so there was a real moral ambiguity to a lot of the things. And in this case, that's a moral ambiguity that I like. When I came back to read Sin City for the podcast, I read the first one, and I haven't read the first one in a very, very, very long time, and I was shocked because I thought, wow, this is a great comic book. Like, this is just one of those stories where everything about Frank Miller that I could think about anything else kind of gets washed away from that book because I loved it so much. And then I thought that A Dame to Kill For, you know, quite a few of the others were really, really good as well. And then around the time of The Family Values and beyond, I actually thought that his art style kind of started to change a little bit in there. Like, he started getting away from the deeper blacks and becoming more of like a hybrid style of like his original style of art and the Sin City style of art. And so I didn't feel that it meshed quite as well. And then the last Sin City story was just, you know, to me it was just fairly average. I mean, still probably a good book, but when you compare it to reading the early issues, all, you know, really clumped close together, it didn't stand up nearly as well.
Okay, I'm going to give you guys a couple quotes here about this one. So Sin City, one of the things that Miller said is, the noir hero is a knight in blood-caked armor. He's dirty and does his best to deny the fact that he's a hero the whole time. Also, he uses for inspiration a quote from Raymond Chandler that's pinned to his wall, saying, "Down these mean streets, a man must go who is not himself mean, who's neither tarnished nor afraid. He is the hero. He is everything. He must be a complete man and a common man and yet an unusual man. He must be the best man in the world and a good enough man for any world." Keith, give us some thoughts on Sin City.
The early stuff is so well crafted, and the way that he the stories weaved in and out of each other, the characters would appear in the background of one story and then be bigger later and have their own tale to tell. A lot of these stories took place in the same night of these first four, like you know, chunks of, four or five chunks of the story. As Brett was talking, I don't necessarily remember the later stuff as well. I mean, I have the whole match set that came out a few years ago, with the matched spines that made a picture of Nancy. And I read them all when I got those, not very long ago, and yet I don't have really strong memories of those last couple of books. I remember the ones that we've together. I remember the ones that, obviously, the ones that are used in the film. One of the great things, though, and to get into the film a bit, the idea of taking those stories and his art and making them the storyboard and making that style of art come alive on screen in that mix of animation and live action with the heavy, heavy CG and green screen, was so innovative. And it was, you know, that same thing going, went into 300, and we'll see it again. It did go into Spirit, but it didn't work in Spirit because, you know, well, one, it was just awful. And it didn't have that source material to draw from. I mean, he was trying to take that style as, you know, and make storyboards out of it. Sin City works as a film because he made the comic book first and then made that storyboard instead of just going right to the storyboard. I love the art style. I love the use of black, and the starkness of it. I remember so clearly getting the Christmas issue, which cost, I forget what the Canadian cover price was on it for, was that called Silent Night? $4.15 or something like that. It was crazy high at the time, for a single issue. And I read it in about 4.5 seconds and was furious. And then, you know, went back after a couple of days, so mad that there was nothing to it because it was almost all one page splashes. And then I just forced myself to slow down from the pace I usually read comics and look at every page and every detail he was putting in there. And some of those books are absolutely perfect. Even though there's so little detail, every detail that's there is important.
Okay, that's cool. I'm going to give you another quote here, just because you brought up a couple things that I have here. One of the things regarding movies, he said, "This is the time to do comic book movies right. Comics are inexpensive to make, but they have the equivalent of an unlimited budget. If I imagine something, I can make it happen. Now with the new blue, green, and green screen technology, you can bring in those values. The new kind of movie blurs the lines between animation and live action. I was always told by people that my style of dialogue wouldn't translate to the screen, but it did. And it looks like there's an audience for stories that don't end with Harry Potter being cheered by schoolmates." Also, in regards to the Spirit, one of the things he said when promoting the film was, "I have one really great advantage in doing this movie. I spent years in training directly from Eisner. Miller has explained, going on to repeat the mantra and now being manly sounding familiar, he and I really did share two profound loves. One was for New York, the other was for beautiful women." So I think that's interesting, since you said it's awful. And, of course, we gave a full review of that book in a Fanboy Film review on an earlier episode. Chris, talk a little bit about your views on Sin City.
Sin City, in my view, is Frank Miller's perfect Frank Miller comic book. This man understands noir. You can feel the Hammett, the Chandler, just permeating from the book. And added to the fact that Frank Miller began with a simple concept. I want to draw babes, cars, and guns. And that's all Frank Miller, that's all Sin City is. And I love it for that. It understands the noir rules and gives me these beautiful visuals. As Keith was saying, you have to slow down reading these. Because particularly as the series goes on, he gets very sparse with the words, as a good noir should. Every word is planned and is meaningful, which makes a comic book reading experience absolutely delightful. I'll agree with you, as the series ended, and I'm just talking about To Hell and Back. I think that is the weakest volume, but there we lose the protagonists from the previous entries, and we have a new protagonist, and he doesn't fit the classic noir mold as well, and I think that's the problem with that volume. But right up into that volume, I think it's Frank doing what Frank does best.
Frank said, I'm a comic book artist, so I think to myself, what do I like to draw? I like to draw hot chicks, fast cars, and cool guys in a trench coat. So that's what I write about. I was always into noir. When I lived in Vermont, I was drawing stuff that looked like an amateur doing Sin City. When I first got to New York, I was swiftly informed they only did guys in tights. Let's talk a little bit about Frank Miller as an artist. Actually, let's go back. One thing I'm going to ask you guys before we move on to that. Because everybody gave their opinion on Sin City. So now that you've read it again recently in preparation for this podcast, are there anything that you guys would find problems with Sin City that you find out of place in this day and age, that you find that you had an issue with that you didn't realize you might, or any problems at all with the series?
All right. I found one thing surprising. I don't know if it's a problem. But when I went back to read The Long Goodbye, I was slightly frustrated by the fact that he wasn't being played by Mickey Rourke. I saw Mickey Rourke in my head, and somehow I was able to transplant that visual into the original comic book art, and it took me 4 or 5 pages to actually get over the fact that it wasn't the actor in there. It was a guy who looked similar, but it wasn't the same image as in the movie, which I had somehow transplanted.
Hey, Brett and Keith, anything? And I know somebody's cat I can hear in the background is also a big Frank Miller fan, apparently.
Yeah, Angus totally is. I think that one of the things that I noted, and I think that there's definitely thematic elements that run through virtually all of his books, is really the way that he writes women. He has his women are tough, but at the same time, you know, there's almost an element to, and I don't want to like put words into.
Is deferential into his mouth. Deferential is kind of the word I would use.
I think that's a good word to use. Yeah, yeah. Just the treatment of women is just, there's just something that doesn't quite ring true to how you would normally expect women to be portrayed.
Brett, with what you're saying there, I'm going to throw this one out, this quote out to you, and then we'll get Keith's thought on this as well, and anything else further from either one of you if you have it. But he said, when you have a brush in your hand, inking a beautiful woman is a lot like running your hands over her. Miller said, it turns me on, okay?
Well, certainly Sin City's highly sexualized. And I think that's the case with the men and the women in it. The women of Old Town, they take care of their own. They're strong. They're tough. But then there's there's occasionally scenes like, I don't know, what do you think we should do, Dwight? You know, we're completely in control of our environment, and you let us handle this. But you know, we probably should just listen to the guy that just turned up. What do you think we should do, Dwight? There's just scenes like that. Deferential is the word that comes to my mind, and it's not about their strength. It's about they give up that control of their environment so quickly when a man they trust comes into the story.
Okay. Any final thoughts there, Brett, Chris?
No, I'm sure something will come up later on, but that I can refer back to.
Yeah, there's another. Yeah, this will come back in one of the other major runs.
Absolutely it will. Okay, let's move on then. I want to talk then about, since we talked about Sin City and how that certainly put them out in the public eye, 300 also obviously did the same thing. His name was all over it, and I think to a lot of people, that's what obviously led to him doing Sin City as a film, I think to a large degree. He has a quote on the 300 Spartans, the 1962 film, and he said that he was taught with his father, was transfixed, and asked his dad if the good guys were going to lose. And his dad told him they were, and he said, I'd never heard of such a thing, and it was a formative moment for me. It changed my idea of what a hero was. Up until then, it always seemed that heroes won, and they got the medal, and they got the girl. Yet, these men died in the middle of nowhere, sacrificing their lives for the greater good. Chris, give your thoughts on 300.
Absolutely gorgeous book. Rife with historical inaccuracies, but I suppose I shouldn't actually make that too much of a point. Absolutely gorgeous, but to me, it's lacking a little bit of story. These characters are not deep at all. You have characters with acting with very little motivation, I feel. I definitely like the more complex take they took in the movie than in the comic book. And as far as the storytelling goes, I actually like the episode of Samurai Jack that tells the same story a whole lot better than the Frank Miller's actual work.
Brett, what do you think?
Well, I got to say, it's one of the nicest hardcovers that I own, because it really is a nice-looking book. Now, again, the first time I read it, I was totally, for the longest time, gaga over Frank Miller. You know, he could pretty much do no wrong, and so anything that I picked up that was Frank Miller was pretty much gold. And 300 came out right around that time. So I loved it. And then I read it again. And you know, I still really enjoyed it because it's a good action-packed story. Is it the single greatest thing that he's ever written? No, it's not. But it's a good action-packed story that translated into a good action-packed movie. And you know, I was in line at Comic-Con to buy a nice extra big set of the 300 movie before it came out anywhere else, and that was just one of those cases where, yep, I got swept along with that fever too. So,
Keith, you haven't given your opinion yet. Please talk about 300.
Well, I will say that that hardcover that Brett mentioned is the only way to read this book. You know, even I don't care what kind of collector you are. You have to have a floppy. You have to have a first print. Screw that. Get the hardcover of this book that is printed widescreen, that prints all of the two-page spreads. This whole book was drawn in two-page spreads. That prints them full width in that hardcover. And it's easy to find that hardcover because there were so many on the market when the film came out. It's a beautiful book. The story is very thin. That's absolutely true. The characters are very thin. They had to add characters. You know, in a world, in a time when you have to cut and cut and cut when you're adapting something to make a film, they had to add plot to 300 to make it into a film. They had to add characters because the Queen was such a thin character in the book. They had to add scenes and things for her to do to make it worthwhile having a character in there to begin with. But it's a beautiful work. It's probably the pinnacle of his art for me.
Well, but is it? How much of this, though, is Lynn Varley? Varney. How do you say his name, Brett?
Her?
Her. Yeah, please.
I believe it's Varley, isn't it?
Varley, yeah. So how much of this, if we talk about the how beautiful this piece of work is, how much of the credit goes to her?
I've never seen it before and after, so actually no, I have no opinion, no thought.
I think that his best work has Lynn Varley.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that, Brett.
You know, I mean, you know, especially for his later style. I mean, obviously Klaus Janson was good for him, but that was a different thing.
It's hard to say what Lynn Varley's overall contribution was, if she's credited as colorist or just width. They had been married. They divorced in 2005, so. I'm assuming that they won't be doing anything coming up. She didn't work on Holy Terror. She's one of those collaborators that seemed to make his work better. Even if it was in a way that, even if it was just her name on it, seemed to carry some weight, that it was going to be a better piece.
Well, and I think I read something at one point that where he just said that, you know, that what she brought was more than just, you know, any colorist could do, that she brought something extra to his art.
Yeah, I always thought that when I looked at that book, I always thought a lot of that was her. But, you know, just seeing if that was just me. Regarding the movie adaptation, I'm just going to say, make it more of a general comment here about the about his talk about movies, and when he was asked, you see any future movie project you'd be interested in working on or perhaps adapting more of your own work to the screen, his comment was, try and stop me. Chris, what do you think about the 300 movie? Kind of a quick overview from you.
To me, it was the perfect action man flick, despite the presence of way too many wieners. It was cinematic perfection. Really, this is what guys want in an action film. Just straight action. Really not a lot of... Yeah, the story is pretty well throwaway, but we got guys fighting elephants and weird creatures, and it's non-freaking stop. Heads being cut off left and right. I have to say, I came out of the theater and went right back in to see it again.
And has there been a more virulent meme than This is Sparta, too? It doesn't go away. I hated the Austin Powers stuff that wouldn't go away, but somehow, every once in a while, there's still a creative This is Sparta joke.
Excellent, excellent. Well, since we're talking about movies, we talked about action movies, let's talk about RoboCop 2 and his work with RoboCop. There's a couple of comic book. He had RoboCop versus the Terminator, and his Frank Miller's RoboCop, which is essentially what the script I believe for RoboCop 2 and 3 would have been if they hadn't been chopped up. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
But of course, the producer said that the script he produced for RoboCop 2 was completely, completely unusual, and it's not a very well thought of movie. Neither is RoboCop 3, which he had his name on, which is many. Some people have said the worst movie ever. So let's talk a little bit about his work with RoboCop, both in the film and the comic book medium. Keith, your thoughts as Brett's cast's given his thoughts. Brett, Keith, see if you can top that. I doubt it.
I have joked that you know, when The Spirit came out and was I thought it was so terrible that it shouldn't have been advertised as from the co-director of Sin City, it should have been advertised as from the writer of RoboCop 2. I mean, they're terrible. You know, RoboCop and Terminator, it's not a well-written story. It's not a well-thought-out story. But it's really cool as a bit of a time capsule. You know, the Walt Simonson art, Frank Miller writing, two of these iconic 80s characters. And, you know, it's, like I said, as a time capsule, as a novelty item, it's pretty cool. I remember, I think they had a gimmick too. They had, cutout figures or something, like stand, like little, it would make a stand.
Yeah, totally. Almost like the dolls, the cutout dolls, yeah. Like the paper dolls kind of thing that you used
to have.
Yeah,
like it was on a cardboard stock, so you could cut them out. Thereby destroying the resale value of these books, which I'm sure they were a fortune. But yeah, it was. I remember almost nothing of the story. I mean, it was just, you know, it's a shoot 'em up with RoboCop in them. But yeah, I mean, it was a neat product of its time.
Chris, what do you think about his work with RoboCop?
Well, I'm going to stay away from the series Keith is talking about, which I believe was RoboCop versus Predator, versus Terminator. I took a bullet on this one. I've rewatched repeatedly RoboCop 2 and 3 and read the series from Avatar. And for years, I had blamed the massive conglomerate of Hollywood for wrecking a Frank Miller film, a film I always wanted to see. However, after watching these films, and reading what Frank Miller had planned for the series, every element that makes those movies suck is intact in the comic book version. I would love to blame the actual translator of Frank Miller's story, Stephen Grant, in the story, because I don't particularly like his writing, but I can't. Frank Miller's script always sucked, and we got some sucky movies out of it. True, the movies are different, but I can't say they added anything that made them worse. than Frank Miller's initial script. I mean, every bad thing that happens in those movies happens in the original script. It was unbelievable to me. I really thought that, you know, someday they'd go back, find the script, remake RoboCop, and I get a good Frank Miller movie. That is not happening. God awful.
Yeah, I'm going to throw this out to you, Chris. I'll get you to react before Brett does, just because off of what you said, his quote on the films. I thought, yeah, I could work in movies, but he was wrong. Studio bosses deemed his film unfilmable. Multiple heavy rewrites followed, and RoboCop 2 tanked. Miller returned for the even less loved RoboCop 3 before throwing the towel. I learned the same lesson. Don't be the writer. The director's got the power. The screenplay is the fire hydrant, and there's a row of dogs around the block waiting for it. Thoughts on that quote, Chris?
The third one should have been good. I mean, they had a director that actually, Frank Decker, I believe, who actually isn't a Hollywood guy. He produced some independent stuff, A Night of the Creeps, A Monster Squad, both excellent films. This movie should have worked. If Frank Miller and Fred Decker could have found some common ground, I think we could have got a good product. I can't believe Frank Miller that he was steamrolled by Hollywood. I would love to, but I can't. I think that's just bullshit he's putting out there to defend a sloppy product.
Brett, your thoughts?
The RoboCop versus Terminator is what it is. It's not really that good, but it's a product of its time, definitely. Whereas that RoboCop Avatar series is shockingly awful. And I tried desperately. Like, I could not read it in one sitting. I had to, like, read one issue, read a bunch of other stuff, go back, read another issue, because there was nothing good about it. I think the one thing that I really want to speak on about it, though, is the fact that it's one of those things that really brings to light another one of those Frank Miller-isms. The anti-authoritarian Frank Miller. There's always something in so many of his books where the authority, it always turns, it's that absolute power corrupts absolutely mentality that Frank seems to have. Because RoboCop is rife with this concept in here. You know, you give this and they just want to build bigger robots. They want to take over. They want to build a police state. And, you know, we see this so much in Frank Miller's work.
Although, well, to be fair, that's original. That's true in the original movie. So I think it's unfair to attribute a lot of that to Frank on these.
Well, no, because it appears in other works.
Well, let's talk
it's not
about
just
Ronan.
A RoboCop.
Let's talk about Ronan. Brett, give your thoughts.
Sorry, Keith, did you have something?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I had noticed for a long time that view, and, you know, we'll get into some of Frank Miller's politics as we go through this. I always mistook that for liberalism, and I guess it's my own lens that I had, because, you know, in hindsight, a lot of this stuff is people who think they're doing the best thing for you, and are limiting your freedoms based on what's good for you, which is, you know, a conservative paranoia view of liberalism as opposed to a liberal's view of corporate control.
And this will absolutely be coming up more than once, I think, before we get done. But as I say, based on kind of what you talk about, Brett, on that, let's move on. Let's talk about his work, Ronin, which I believe like 1986 he did that?
I feel like it's 83.
So it's even earlier. He was still, that's right, he was, that's when he stopped penciling Daredevil in order to, he continued writing it, but he did this as a miniseries for DC, I believe. And so that was his first, interesting just to think in this day and age where nobody works for both companies at the same time that he was doing that. But Brett, tell me a little bit about what you think about Ronin.
Well, I thought actually that he was taking time off from Daredevil, and because he was
perhaps,
kind of upset
yeah.
with the Marvel machine, as Frank Miller does get upset with the companies all the dang time. But But yeah, Ronin was his first work for DC. And, you know, Ronin is a great work. I really like Ronin. It's one of those stories that that it's really hard to describe, but so many of his, he's building so many of the themes that we'll see later on in his career, no question about it. I mean, even the, like, just some of the uses of technology, that kind of thing. I mean, it's a totally different style for him. There is a lot of that, you know, authoritarian government kind of dystopian element to it. And, you know, I think it's a really good book, but it's not the first book that's on my list of Frank Miller to read.
Chris, your thoughts on it?
I have a difficult relationship with Ronin. I can't actually say I like it. I go back to it every couple of years and go, maybe I'm going to get it this time. I enjoy, I believe it's Gibbon's art. I enjoy that. I enjoy a lot of the concepts in it. And, I mean, there are several issues in that series that I really love. But at the
just
end...
Just one second. Can somebody look that up? Because I'm not... I didn't think that somebody else did the art on that one.
No, it's Frank Miller.
It is Frank Miller.
Oh, it's a completely different...
You're, yeah,
completely
you're
different
Martha
style,
Washington.
Then.
Well, because he's trying hard, really hard to incorporate a lot of the Japanese elements into the art in mm-hmm. that case, so he is playing around.
But in the end, I'm always left with the empty feeling. Is it bad? No. I just wish it was more complete. Somehow I believe, I somehow need Ronin for Dummies to get through this, some sort of Cole's Notes. And, I mean, I like complex stuff, but it's a whole lot of reading, and they do go quickly, and there's a whole lot there. Ronin's not a series I'm going to lend out going, you have to read this. Unlike something like Sin City, which Frank Miller has refined his style to a point where anyone can understand what's going on, and you can just marvel at the genius behind it. Ronin takes a lot of work, and I'm not 100% behind it.
You know, I like complex work, too, but sometimes complex work doesn't like me. I think, Chris, actually, I think you summed this one up pretty well for me. But, you know, I do appreciate the fact that Miller did try and expand his style in both his narrative, his art style, and in many ways, and away from traditional superhero work at an early age and an early point in his career still, too, though. Keith, what do you think of it?
Well, I first want to place this in time. 83 and 84 is when this came out, a six-issue miniseries from DC. It is in the break between the Daredevil he did with Jansen and then when he came back to do Born Again with Mazzucchelli.
Okay.
And this is an important creator-owned work. That's something that often gets forgotten, is that this... Ronin is a creator-owned work that is under permanent license to DC, but it is creator-owned, and probably this a similar deal to before Watchmen, or sorry, Watchmen. So maybe we'll have a before Ronin eventually. But that same kind of, you know, it's never reverted.
I can hear the fanboys screaming already.
I would love
actually.
A
I'd just like to see that. How is that even possible?
It's really old stories.
First, you have to find someone who understood Ronin. I read this just recently for the podcast. It holds up as well as it ever did in that it still doesn't quite make sense to me. It's really cool art. He was really playing with something, and it is the bridge between what he was doing on Daredevil and what he would later do on Batman. As far as his art style,
I think the proper transition from Ronin, personally, since I'm running the ship on this one and largely keeping my mouth shut, I'm going to throw it out to a book that won the Eisner Award. I think this is 1992, Hard Boiled, from Dark Horse. Certainly an early, we talk about the explicit content in Black Kiss there. Or was it Black Kiss? What was it? Was it Black Kiss a couple weeks ago? Yeah. This book is one of the early examples of that from a more mainstream project as well that I certainly experienced. So the Jeff Darrow and Frank Miller won the Eisner Award for Best Writer-Artist Combine for this. I think it was a three-issue miniseries from Dark Horse, Hard Boiled. And Keith, we're going to get your thoughts here first.
Well, I recently listened to a Jeff Darrow spotlight from one of the conventions that had turned up online, and he talked
really because he wouldn't talk to us. We tried, and he said he doesn't like giving interviews.
He didn't think that he was interesting enough.
It wasn't an interview, actually. It was someone had recorded his panel. If he's not doing our show, he's not doing anyone's show. Let's be honest. And it was interesting.
Nicely done.
His perspective of that book. I mean, it was just really them. You know, Darrow had studied in Japan and was bringing a very different style, and they played with a lot of things. And it was interesting that one of the bits that came out of that was that they had kept looking for something else to do together, and Darrow almost did Daredevil: Man Without Fear. That eventually was done by Romita. He was actually in talks with Miller to do it at one point. It's a really cool book. It's crazy. It's I'm sure that Darrow gets asked 15 times an hour at a convention, how long does it take you to draw that little detail? Because I heard him at the panel give the same answer that he gave when I asked him at his table at the Calgary convention, which is that doing the little windows is what takes so long, because once you draw one, you have to draw them all. And it was almost word for word the same answer, so it must be his stock answer. Give him a dollar if you hear him use the I have to draw all the little windows answer.
You have an opinion on that book there, Chris?
Yeah, I actually had to go back and read a Hard Boiled recently, and I didn't discover it on its initial run. I had actually been into Frank Miller, and it wasn't actually being published for a long time. It took me a long time to actually track down and read. And now I think of it as supplemental to other Frank Miller and Jeff Darrow work. Whenever I read one of their books, I go back to Hard Boiled and go, oh, okay, I can see. They were playing with so much. It's more of an experimental book. I don't think it's completely readable all on its own. I think it's kind of stupid all on its own. But it's interesting in context to other work.
Yeah, that's probably you might have opened my eyes a little bit there, Chris, because, I mean, like I said, this book, what I'm looking at, I'm going, it won the Eisner Award, Best Writer, Artist Duo. And I'm going, that's the Frank Miller hype of how much people love him. Because Darrow's art is very, very fine in this book, but I hate this frickin' thing. I think it's just awful. I think the characterizations are bad, the dialogue terrible, and the narrative structure unreadable and horrible. And I look back and I go, wow, it was so popular and it did this. But so I was kind of curious, but maybe when you say it was experimental and it's a compliment or helped fuse some of his later work, maybe that's the way I should look at it. Brett, what do you think of Hard Boiled?
Well, what you say about the hype is absolutely right. Because, this is a book that I read when it came out, or just after it was collected. And it was right in that hype for the world, but that hype for me. That where I was like, yes, Frank Miller, and he can do no wrong, and Hard Boiled is just crazy. And, you know, like Keith said about the Silent Night issue of Sin City, this took me like 10 minutes to read all three issues, because there's just so little there, unless you really want to delve into the art. And I tell you, that's the best thing to do, is delve into the art, because you're absolutely right. As I read it again, you know, I had this glorious vision of like, oh, this is going to be so much fun. I'm going to enjoy this. And at the end of it, I was just kind of like, that wasn't the book that I thought it was. You know, come to think of it, maybe I don't enjoy this book as much as I thought. But, you know, Chris, I do think that you've got something there, absolutely, with that concept. Because we do see Nixon show up elsewhere. And we definitely see a lot of the concepts as well pop up elsewhere. So it does seem to be a transitional book as well.
I was falling for a fight on this one. I thought you guys would love it, and I would be the only one hanging back on the fence post on this one.
No, it's really just not a good book.
Art's beautiful.
The art is amazing. Here's the quote I'm going to throw in about from Frank Miller here. And any final thoughts we'll just get from Keith on Hard Boiled based on our conversation here. But he said, "I will throw out all my best efforts into it. My thoughts and political observations." And this isn't just about Hard Boiled. This is when his creative process. "I will throw all my best efforts into it, my thoughts and political observations. But ultimately, I want to create a narrative that keeps you turning the pages and leaves you with a sense that this thing has a reason for being there." Any final thoughts based on what we said here, Keith?
In light of it has a reason for being here, I don't know. I enjoy the book. I come back to it fairly regularly. But I don't worry. It's one of those pretty forgettable stories because there isn't that much to it. It's quite thin. It's more, a beautiful book as opposed to a good book.
Well, coming off of Hard Boiled, I think we have to talk about the other project that Darrow and Miller did together for Dark Horse, and that's The Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot. Keith?
I wish there was more of this. I wish they had revisited these characters a bit more. I mean, most of the things I would say about Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot is what I said about Hard Boiled. There's not a whole lot of story to it. It was quite silly. It felt like it should have been part of something bigger, though. I kind of wish, every once in a while the characters show up in another book, mostly by Darrow. And, it's a goofy book. It is a book I have given away as a gift, though, just because it is fairly obscure and the oversized collection of it, because it was one of those oversized magazines like Storyteller that you can't really find a good spot to put on your shelf. Not a lot of people have ever seen it. So it makes a great gift for not a whole lot of cash, and no one's going to have seen it, and they're going to see those names on the front and go, "Hey, I have never heard of this." So, which was, I think that was exactly the reaction and possibly the voice of the person I gave to.
You know, it's funny that you say that it's kind of obscure since it had an animated TV show based on it. Chris, what do you think of it?
I actually have a lot of anger towards this book, but that has more to do with the oversize than the actual content. God, I've damaged many copies of this thing. Will not fit in a long box no matter what you do. Hate the thing. The story, I mean, this is a story I should love. I love Frank Miller. It came out at a point that Frank Miller could do no wrong. It's beautifully drawn. I love Astro Boy. I should love this book. I love anime. I should love this book. As it is, it's such a nothing that I have a hard time saying it should be even included in Frank Miller's biography his list of works. It's such an odd piece that it doesn't seem to belong. I will say I like the cartoon show much more than the books, available free on Crackle if anyone's interested in actually seeing it.
How about you, Brett?
I am actually very interested in seeing the cartoon show. I haven't seen it, and given the style of Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot, then no question, I think it would fit in nicely. Again, this is because he was so busy in that period where he wrote this and Hard Boiled and Sin City in the 90s. There, he was putting out a lot of stuff, and absolutely, I enjoyed this book then. And upon rereading it, I don't like this book at all.
And why is that?
I think just because I was really hoping for something more. And when the story ended, it was just like, wow, I really dislike most of these characters. And I don't actually want to see them come back in any way, shape, or form comic book-wise. Because I don't think Frank Miller has the right voice for them.
You know what? It's funny. They are more likable in the cartoon. I've seen a couple episodes. I really enjoyed that, too. Chris, you had another thought there?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because I think this is the last work that we're going to talk about that is so heavily influenced by a manga. I would love for somebody to publish an art book of Frank Miller's work on Lone Wolf and Cub. Cub, I don't think we're going to talk about that today because he only did the covers. But he did several of them. I'd love to see an art book, and if you want to see Frank Miller at his best, I think those covers are definitely representative of the man's talent.
Yeah, well, those covers are they're the reason that I originally bought that book when it first came out. You know,
and the book is so damn good on the inside too.
Oh yeah, great stuff.
But as great as the covers are, just doing covers and a foreword isn't enough to really go into it in depth. So I didn't have it on the list here. So, but we will talk about, since we talk about the big guy and Rusty the Boy Robot, the continuity here. See, that continuity is so important. So this last title contained the word boy. So will this next title, Bad Boy? Chris, Bad Boy.
I actually thought this was originally published in 2000 AD. It's not. It's GQ. Or European
UK,
GQ,
yeah.
Isn't it?
UK GQ,
Couldn't believe that. Really, this is a nice Frank Miller aside. Simon Beasley does a wonderful job. If you haven't read it, I don't know if I'd recommend it. But if you're hanging out on a Saturday and you got nothing else to do, good way to waste 15 minutes. Gorgeous, but not terribly deep. I wouldn't read a sequel, but for what it is, it's great.
How about you, Keith?
I don't like it at all. I've never been a fan of Beasley though, and possibly because my first exposure to him was on Lobo, and I've always hated Lobo. So, you know, it may be that, but I just don't,
you
I don't care for his style.
Bastich. Love Lobo.
I don't care for Beasley's style. So I never got into the book, and it's kind of an oddity for the time that it came out. I mean, the 90s was such a grand time for Miller with works like Sin City and Martha Washington that were so scoping, and then to have these weird projects on the side. I think kind of I didn't like it. It's the only thing I want to stick with there.
Hey, Brett, what do you think of it?
Well, I love Biz. I think that Simon Bisley rocks. He's that look of heavy metal kind of guy, and, you know, I dig his Lobo penis in the elbow art and stuff like that. But really, man, this book sucks. This is just a terrible book. I just don't have any interest in the story. I don't like the characters. And it's just, again, another fine example of the anti-authoritarian Frank Miller. But the book is just plain bad. I will never, ever read Bad Boy again. Flat out, never, ever.
It's just not happening, huh?
No,
come on,
not
guys. The book stars a horny 4-year-old. I thought I could count on one of you guys to back me up on this.
You know what? Let's just talk.
When you think horny 4-year-old, do you think of us? I'm not okay with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think other things. That's what I want you to do.
I have a 4-year-old. He's nothing like that. And woo!
You know, let's talk about this because it's weird. This is one of his quotes. So I'll just throw this out there. I don't really plan on running out of material because I'm doing the comics or that I'm still doing comics. There's material in my head that could go on forever. If that's the material, maybe it shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
Well, wait until we get further.
We're going to talk a little bit about some more superhero type fare. I'm going to have a couple more quotes for me here. Regarding superheroes. Here's one. It says, the fundament of a superhero is the guy in tights saving innocent people from bad things. It's amazing how infrequently that seems to happen in superhero comics these days. One of these is a book he wrote, and it's a one-shot. One of these is he just did the art, though. It's obvious from the characters and the art and the style that he had some influence. But so we'll just go over really quickly, kind of throw them together. Keith, do you have any thoughts on Wolverine and Spawn and his work over there?
Wolverine and also Spawn is what you're trying to say to me.
That's five issues combined.
There's no book named Wolverine and Spawn that I don't remember reading. It was on a list somewhere, and I've never. I Well, Wolverine is one of the quintessential Frank Millers, and I don't like it. I've tried over and over to enjoy that miniseries, and I just don't. I like the art. It's the same style that he was doing his work was taking in Daredevil. I keep thinking I should like it, and I don't know how many times I've tried to read that book, and I just don't. I don't know why it doesn't work for me, but it just doesn't connect. And Spawn is Spawn. I mean, if you like Spawn, more power to you. I wish you would like something else.
I just can't, I don't like Wolverine. I don't like the character. But man, I love that miniseries. That's the only time I really understood and get that character and feel for him and relate to him. So I'm surprised to hear you say that to some degree. Spawn, you're probably right on that.
I'd never say that the Wolverine mini is bad. On the outside, I can see the quality of the work. I just don't like it. It just doesn't connect with me. In the same way that a lot of Punisher at that time didn't connect with me.
Like I say, that's what's unique about it for me, is it's the one that actually does connect with me. The Spawn, we should say, who else was it? It was Dave Sim. It was him.
Gaiman.
Alan Moore. They're the ones who came on and kind of as a marketing ploy did these penciled some issues for McFarlane. I think the Gaiman is the only one that people seem to recall as being of high quality.
And I think that's only because of the lawsuit. I think that would be very forgotten.
The debut, the introduction of the character, and was it Angelique?
Angela,
yeah. The character people like quite a bit. So did you have any thoughts on Spawn and Wolverine, Brett?
Well, Wolverine is a good miniseries. I don't have very much to say about it. I like his art. It's very consistent with the Daredevil, as Keith said. And I can read it any time if I so desire. The Spawn, I was debating, more so in just that I can get through it.
it just sounded like you have the trade paperback. So,
so therefore, I can read it.
It's readily available.
Yes. But The Spawn, on the other hand, I was debating on whether or not I actually wanted to even try to read it coming into this. And then I thought, given the fact that there's Batman Spawn crossover, I thought, damn it, I'm going to read this Spawn issue. And the one good thing that I can say about it is that it's less written than a Todd McFarlane written issue. It's much faster to get through than a standard Todd McFarlane. Like, Todd McFarlane's art is always Todd McFarlane's art, but Frank Miller's script is just garbage, and the character sucks, and there's really... Man, again, I hate this book, and if I ever read it again, then I'm going to have myself committed to an insane asylum, because I know how bad it sucks, and there's no good reason to read it.
So what do you really think, Brett?
Overall, it sucks. That's my review.
I'll give it a 3.5 out of 5.
Let's say another quote from him here. The Greeks had their gods and heroes. We have ours. What are they here for? Another one here, because I thought his Spawn did have a certain noir element, and just to go back to that, of course, that we know he's heavily influenced by that. I've always wanted to do crime stories. That's my favorite thing to read. I grew up reading Mickey Spillane, Raymond Chandler, and Dashiell Hammett. I've always thought they'd make excellent comic books, so I thought he inspired that Spawn with that. I don't think it was as bad. I thought you guys are a little hard on it, but maybe it's just me. Yep. Let's talk about his. Since we talked about
Chris, how about my thoughts on that one?
Oh, Chris, so we did not get to you yet.
Yeah, no, we haven't. I'm going to be quick on this one. Spawn, Batman.
We're not there yet. Just Spawn.
Sorry. The Frank Miller Spawn. See my review. It sucks. Wolverine. Chris Claremont, Frank Miller, this is the perfect Marvel comic book. I don't understand you guys' criticism. This was one of the books I first fell in love with. Absolutely great. Art, writing, both these men were at the top of their creative powers. Works for me. Love it.
Okay, let's talk about, since we're talking about his superhero work, let's move on to very important superhero work, kind of what put him on the map in the first place in people's eyes. And I have about a billion and one quotes. I'm just going to finish up one that's more along the lines of a hero in general, and that's when he said, "My feeling is that the hero has now been defined by phrases like the odious one that we're all raised with, crime does not pay. Of course it pays, you schmuck. That's not why we don't do it. We don't do it because it's wrong." Let's talk about Frank Miller's work on Daredevil. Brett, why don't you open up on this one? I imagine there'll be quite a bit of discussion regarding Daredevil.
Oh, there probably will be. The interesting thing is that because of the weird numbering and the McKenzie stuff, and then the fact that he came back, and the fact that he was off for a couple of issues, and that there's a couple of issues, you know, just before he came back to do Born Again, I had actually never read the early part of the run in its entirety. So when I was able to sit down and go through it, it was great because I was able to see young Frank Miller at his peak. And I think in one of the introductions on one of the Visionaries, it mentioned, I think it was Ralph Macchio, who mentioned that Frank Miller was a guy who hung around the bullpen and just wanted to learn. He wanted to be and hang out with all the different people that were working in comics at the time. And he was hungry. And I think as you see him, especially as he takes over on Daredevil from McKenzie, you can see and really experience that hunger, because what he's bringing to Daredevil and comic books is really different, because he's bringing a lack of a desire to put somebody in tights. He's bringing a desire to tell the character's story outside of the tights. And I think that, to me, is what defines his work on Daredevil. The absolute best thing about Daredevil is Born Again. You know, to me, this story is one of my favorite comic book stories, period. And I've read it like 5 or 6 times, and I will always want to go back and reread it. And to me, it just stands up so well to this day. But Frank Miller is one of those rare people who has been able to define a character so completely that you can't even get, like, to this day, people will still talk about Frank Miller's work on Daredevil, because he just did such a good job of defining the character.
Yeah, as they should, Brett, as they should. That's really well put, Brett. I'm just going to throw out a couple quotes here, and I have quite a bit of them regarding Daredevil, and I'm going to use them all, damn it. But I'm just going to say, because kind of in tune with what you said there, one of his quotes was, "It was said Daredevil grew up in Hell's Kitchen, an amazing name for a neighborhood. But that opened a Pandora's box of all the crime and stuff I wanted to do. I borrowed liberally from Will Eisner's The Spirit and turned Daredevil into a crime comic. I figured Daredevil must be Catholic because only a Catholic could be both an attorney and a vigilante." Chris, I'm not going to forget you this time. Let's give you your opinion on his work on Daredevil.
Well, going back and reading these issues from the beginning, which is something I've done before, but what struck me the most this time is how fully formed Daredevil is right off the bat. As soon as Frank Miller takes over full scribing responsibilities, we have Daredevil as we know him today. He goes straight to the heart of it. He the book might as well be called Matt Murdock. Usually with a new writer, you know, there's a little bit of fooling around and trying to find himself. None of that there. It is clear that he has a vision, and he's taking this character there. I find it completely amazing that a man can reinvent something so early in his career. Born Again goes up there on the shelf with just about any comic book. It is one of the best works in all of comicdom. Really, I've reread it several times, and it just doesn't lose any of its luster. I will say, when he came back and did the issues with Romita, I didn't enjoy it as much, but I think his art was integral to what Daredevil was. And that said, I mean, I do enjoy the Man Without Fear issues, but that's that. I mean, I would have preferred if he drew them as well.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because when he stopped doing it, and was it Jansen who took over and did the art, I thought it was even better. I thought the weakness was the art. I thought the stories were great. I mean, I think Frank Miller does some of the best action and fighting scenes ever, but other than that, his early art to me is just very standard Marvel style. So, I mean, and it looked to me the influence on when the art got better was all from the inking, and that continued when he was no longer, it was just him writing. So in my opinion, but I see what you're saying though.
Still great comic books, and I'm never going to criticize Jansen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's, I'm going to talk, Keith, why don't you go ahead and, give us your thoughts here. I have a few more quotes, but I'll get to them in a moment.
Well, I read these in a different form or a different order than I had read them before. I think I had read them kind of piecemeal. And this time I read Man Without Fear first. And I also read Loeb and Sale's Daredevil Yellow with that. And it was, and recently read the Daredevil Season 1. And it was interesting having read those in a very short amount of time. Miller's origin of Daredevil is still the origin of Daredevil. And he invented so much of that material during his run on the regular series. But your picture of battling Jack Murdock is Miller's version. It's not from other places in Daredevil. I mean, that stuff was there in bits, but until he laid it out. And then, you know, when I read Yellow and when I read the Season 1, I realized just how it felt so repetitious, because they're just trying to tell what Miller had done so well to start with. Those are superfluous stories because Miller's already done the definitive origin of Daredevil. The one negative thing I will say about Frank Miller's Daredevil, and this is the most, well, if you have a backhanded compliment, I don't know if you can have a backhanded insult, but because of Born Again, and because Born Again is one of those near perfect works, ever since then, every writer wants to out Born Again Daredevil. They want to out Miller. Exactly. But I mean, I think every writer has fallen into it. And I think I'm going to drop Mark Waid's Daredevil, because I think he's just starting down the same road of, you know, build Daredevil up for a few issues just so you can knock him down again. And, you know, I was really enjoying Waid's version, because it's the first time I'd read Daredevil in so long where they weren't trying to out Miller Frank Miller. And they weren't trying to just invent a new friend for Matt Murdock so you can kill him. I will say that the accusations of misogyny in Miller's work, this is unfortunately one of the places that it does turn up, and that it's a bit more pronounced than other places. One of the lines in an issue I was just reading today, he's dating a woman who has inherited a large corporation, and says to her that they should get married so she can stop playing executive. You know, and certainly Murdoch's going through some hardships at this time. But
was it Murdoch who said that, or was it the vice president of the company?
No, it was Murdoch who said that, because he had proposed, and then she should stop playing executive.
Yeah, that was a crazy moment. Like, that was almost unexpected in the run at the time.
Certainly, that it was a character who wasn't presented as being capable of doing that, and I thought he seemed to make her more capable later on. Maybe there was some backlash to that. Who knows? But you're right. It's probably an early example of some of his attitudes taking place. I'm going to give another quote here regarding his Daredevil work. He said, "I'd been lobbying for the job. A previous artist, Gene Colan, was screaming off it. He'd done so many issues. And I kind of thought Daredevil was cool because he couldn't do anything. I mean, he's blind. It wasn't that he could fly. His major power was an impediment. Not impotent. He might be impotent, but no, his major power was an impediment. So I was intrigued. When I took over, he was kind of like Spider-Man Light. But it was my project to add a lot of Catholic imagery onto it. I had always wanted to do a crime comic. It's a seminal piece of work, and it always will be. It'll never not be a great piece of work. What about the Man Without Fear miniseries, Brad?
Keith, do you have something about that before I go on about Man Without Fear? Or?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that there's a reference in one of the Visionaries' introductions where they mention that they seem to be just grabbing every Spider-Man character that wasn't nailed down. And it's because of Frank Miller's run that we think primarily of the Kingpin as a Daredevil villain. He never was. He was a Spider-Man villain until then. Yeah. But he doesn't work as a Spider-Man villain. The picture of him that you have in your head is Miller's version of Kingpin, and the character works as as a Daredevil villain.
I would disagree with that, because after that, I mean, if you read Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, 175 to 200, which I believe was Bill Mantlo's writing, he was the same Kingpin, but was excellent as a Spider-Man villain, leading into the issue number 200 throwdown between Spider-Man and Kingpin that was awesome. So, I mean...
That was trying to grab the character back, though. I mean, I think that they had built him from a thug in Spider-Man and into the real Kingpin of crime.
He was fleshed out by Daredevil, but I don't know that it meant that he couldn't work in Spider-Man as well. I agree, he is more of a Daredevil villain, for sure.
For me, The Man Without Fear, like when I originally read it, I didn't think that much of it. I wasn't sure about it. I was reading it on a month-to-month basis, and I wasn't reading it on its own, like, just as a compilation. So this time, when I read it as a compilation, I got a lot more out of it. And I think I also got a lot more out of it reading it after the issues. Because I think that it's really nice to see the genesis within the main Daredevil series of Daredevil, of Batlin Jack Murdock, of the characters that show up there. And then by the time you see it in, and certainly Elektra, by the time you see it in The Man Without Fear, it's the culmination of all that work packaged together beautifully. You know, and this is one case where I absolutely love Romita Jr.'s art. It works perfectly for the story. And I do. I think it's a really excellent book and a great way for Frank Miller to kind of say goodbye to the Daredevil character in this case.
You know what, Brett? You just said everything I wish I could have said, but said it better. Beautifully done. Here's a couple more quotes, though, about his run on Daredevil, because I think this is kind of interesting. You have to keep in mind, we talked in the Beers in the Patio episode a couple of weeks ago there about characters we would have lost or could have lost or have been gone. And Daredevil, as popular and important as he seems to the Marvel Universe now and in pop culture even to some degree, we almost lost him because that character was just about done. A couple of quotes regarding the book. So Marvel handed it to Miller. Miller was given the book because he was cheap, says Des Skin, founder of the trade publications Comics International. The guy had been doing a couple of jobs here and there. He didn't have his own regular strip, and they were short of artists. They gave him a free hand. If the book isn't selling well, you can't really do any harm on it. Alan Moore said the book was coughing blood. They were going to cancel it in a couple months. When Daredevil was down to 15,000 copies and it's obvious no one could actually make it sell any less, well, they might as well give it this Frank Miller guy a go. Thoughts about that, Keith?
I think one of those examples of giving free rein to an artist and having them surprise you, it reminds me so much of the legend of the creation of Spider-Man, that Amazing Fantasy was going to be canceled. They had one last issue, and the boss said, I don't know, Stan, just write something for this one last issue, and it's going to get canceled anyway. It doesn't really matter what goes in it. And great things can come out of that desperation, What's the phrase? Dance like no one's watching.
Let's talk then about Elektra. Chris, let's give your thoughts on his works with the Elektra character and the character itself and his creation with her.
I think his Elektra work within the Daredevil series is some of his best. I fell in love with this character, and to some degree with the Bullseye as well, because I mean Bullseye, in my estimation, is one of the stupidest characters ever created. He throws stuff, but in that Elektra run, which is collected under the title Elektra Lives, I believe, he all of a sudden became a viable threat. I love that particular run. I can't say I love too much of what Elektra became after that. I keep wanting to see Elektra return to her glory, but I don't think it's possible. Now, did you want me to go into Elektra the Assassin as well?
Yeah, you're talking Elektra, dude.
Yeah. No, just check it. Elektra the Assassin is a strange one for me. Coincidentally, Elektra number one, published by Epic, was the only comic book my mother has ever read. She read
Jesus.
It when I...
That's yeah. not good.
No,
that's not good.
It's not good. I was 12 years old. I have vivid memories of sneaking in my Elektra number one because it was a mature label book, and my mother, for some reason, she had never done this before or since, said, "Let's have a look at these comic books you're reading." And she read it, and I actually stand by a review. It would be pornography if it wasn't so beautifully drawn. This is not a good story. I never read it in the original form after promised my mother I would drop the book immediately. It took me years to collect the issues. And I have to say, my perceptions of this book are colored by that one instant. It was the comic book that screwed things up for me. My mother never banned me from comic books, but I also knew that she thought comic book readers were a little bit perverted ever since that one incident of my childhood. And reading Elektra the Assassin again, I can't disagree with her completely. I don't like the book.
You know, I got to say a couple points off of that. Number one, we talk about his misogynistic nature. Certainly seems to come out in this book, just in Elektra Assassin. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure what year this was. I think it was like 88 or something like that, or 87. Anybody have any idea?
86.
86. So this is early Frank Miller. To me, you're right, this is a bad book. And I wish your mom hadn't read it, not just for, I don't think it's as nearly as pornographic as your memory might serve, or like you say, you're colored by that, but it's such a damn acid trip. I mean, Jesus. I would never want anybody to read that book. It's not a good piece of work, really, I'd have to say. The first crack in the armor for Frank Miller when he was on such a run with Daredevil and he seemed to be such a genius. We've seen his work. We talked about it here. It's like, we love this. I hate this. I love this. I hate this. This would be in the first crack in the armor for what might come, I think, from him as a creator. Keith, why don't you give your thoughts on it? On Elektra and Elektra in general, the character, Assassin, Born Again, whatever, you know.
Well, Sienkiewicz is such an acquired taste to start with. And, I mean, this was an attempt. It was subtitled The Lost Years. I'm not actually that much for Elektra, I gotta be honest. Rereading these Daredevils, the character's a bit thin. I think because when you have the work as a whole, you put later pieces back into it. And some of those pieces come from Elektra Assassin. Some of them come from other stories like Light Man Without Fear, there's not a whole lot in those original issues about Elektra. They knew each other in school.
Can I just say one of the things about Elektra Assassin that I hated, since we're talking about this, was how all of a sudden she had Professor X's powers. That wasn't in the book before. I always tried to figure out if this was in continuity or not.
Some ninja powers or something? At that point, ninjas could do pretty much anything.
I actually don't think it was in continuity. I think it was originally written as to be outside of continuity.
And how do you say it? Sienkiewicz?
Sienkiewicz.
Sienkiewicz, yeah. You say acquired taste? I love his covers. I don't love his interiors at all. I don't think he tells a story well. Beautiful, but great covers. That's why. But anyways, it's your show, guys. Go ahead, Keith. Sorry.
So, yeah, I mean, and there's a couple of... there's an oddity, too, that gets reprinted every once in a while, and it's the... back in the old days of What If, they actually would get creators who worked on these characters to do What If stories. Yeah, any What If that's been done, in most of our listeners' lifetime was done by whoever worked the cheapest. But What If Volume 1, number 35, is Frank Miller writing and penciling What If Elektra Had Lived.
That's in the Visionaries trade paperback as well, isn't it?
I think it's included
in the other part.
I don't think it is, actually. I know the Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. is.
What if Matt Murdock had been an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Okay.
I believe it's in the... There's a complete Elektra hardcover that is...
Okay.
It probably goes for $850,000 on Amazon stores. It's been out of print for a long time, but I believe it has that and it has Elektra Lives Again. As well as Elektra Assassin. Elektra Assassin's just been reissued in trade.
Unfortunately,
yeah. It's a muddy story. It is so incredibly overwritten. A staggering amount.
She's
of text
not
on
really
the, page.
The lead character either in it. What is the character? Garrett? Some John Garrett or something like that?
She's a bit of a MacGuffin. I mean, she kind of was in Miller's original run too. Like I say, a lot of that lead character
was so disgusting. Again, we talk about the misogynistic nature and the disgusting character, unlikable character.
Yeah, I think one can put aside Elektra as outside of his work on Daredevil. It doesn't quite fit with the Daredevil work, and probably better not to think of it as part of that.
Brett, what do you think? What do you think about Elektra?
Well, I was really shocked reading the books, how little Elektra actually was in them. Because we do have this vision that Frank Miller's run is like, if Frank Miller wrote 20 issues, that 18 had Elektra in them. And it's really more like 3.
Yeah, because I think she was killed in like her sixth appearance or something like that, fifth or sixth appearance, which is really surprising.
Yeah, there's just so little Elektra actually there. And I think the character, I did like the character, but yeah, Keith, I think you're right that she's not terribly well fleshed out. And I think for me, that was the big surprise when it's just like, wow, there's no Elektra here, really. Brett, in and out.
That said, as we talk about thinking that she was there for 18 or 20 issues, and I say it was her 5th or 6th, that issue where it showed their love affair in college is probably so well written and such a good character piece that I think that's why people think she was around much more. And I think that one really resonated. I think that's what did it.
Well, and I also, it's a great example of how much Frank Miller did for Daredevil. How much people take Frank Miller's work and really just use it over and over again. That Elektra, a character who really only appeared in like 5 or 6 issues, could become one of the most important Daredevil characters that there is. And then, absolutely, you go into the 8-issue miniseries, and I was on such a high from reading Daredevil. And then it was like I'm the Flash, and I'm suddenly stuck in mud or something like that. Because it was like, again, it was like that whole, you're banging your head against a wall, just like, get to a point, say something interesting, because... I like Sienkiewicz's art and I like his interiors, but there's nothing really understandable in the entirety of the eight issues that
that runs.
Acid
trip.
Yeah, and I just, the only thing that I wanted out of it was just for it to be finished. I just slugged through it and like, okay, issue six, okay, issue seven, come on, issue eight, just come, you know, and I think that if I just read issue one and issue eight, I would have been just as well off as reading all of them. The big book, the Elektra Lives Again, is it?
Yeah.
I do find better.
Yeah, it is a better.
It's
book.
A better story, but
absolutely
not. But still, like, it still doesn't stand up to his work on Daredevil.
Okay, so regarding Elektra, of course, she was killed, as we mentioned.
Really?
This is a quote. Yes, that was a bit of an arc, wasn't it? Miller chuckles in One Afternoon in New York. I was stunned by how deeply connected to the story people were. There were three death threats. I went to Marvel to pick up the mail. Usually you get a dozen letters. There were hundreds. You killed the woman I love, and now I'm coming after you. It was bold at the time, even though the character hadn't been around that long. You just didn't see characters, especially characters that were popular, and she helped turn the book from bi-monthly to a monthly book. She was such a popular character. You didn't see them getting killed. So how about the fact that back in, what, 1982, 1983, whenever it was there, he killed the character. Thoughts on that, Brett?
Well, I think it just speaks to how Frank Miller views anything. I think Frank Miller is willing to kill any character at any given time. The only thing that really matters to him is the story.
This was a book for grown-ups. This was not, and I don't mean this is a mature reader's book, but I mean to his Daredevil, I think that's, to me, that's the legacy of it, is right from the beginning, it's a book for grown-ups.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. I mean, the things that he did were, like I said earlier, it was different from anything else.
I do think when Elektra was, and I know this one I'm going off on because I can't not talk about Daredevil and Elektra, but I do think that when she was killed, though, his characterization of Daredevil was a little bit off, but I think one of the issues you can't ignore is the issue where he's just sitting there playing Russian roulette with Bullseye. What a brave and original story. Any thoughts on that one, Chris?
No, none comes to mind. I'm actually sort of glad he killed her. I think killed Elektra, though. I think all the great story arcs we've had with Elektra since then have borne witness that killing her probably was the right move there. But as far as that issue, I don't really care.
No,
I remember the issue. I don't remember it being all that pivotal.
Really? Whereas, you have to remember, it's probably one of the most controversial books ever published. In many ways, it was more controversial than her death.
Great
Any
cover.
Thoughts? Yeah, a great cover. Great, great cover. Any thoughts on it, Brett or Keith?
Keith?
It's interesting. I mean, Elektra was really a plot device, and she was really a plot device to set Daredevil and Bullseye against each other in an arch nemesis kind of way. I mean, you know, Daredevil didn't necessarily have an arch nemesis like that. And this was a way to make, you know, Bullseye one of these characters that he would hate forever. One of the first comics that I remember reading, it isn't one of the Frank Millers, but it's in the middle of when he was away, was issue 200 of Daredevil, when he and Bullseye finally had it out. You know, this is so important to Daredevil today that this character is still around, even though Elektra's been back and for, you know, decades. But the two of them always have this, you know, and it raised Bullseye to a whole different level, just his brutality.
I just want to say for myself that I think that it's one of the first issues where you really see Daredevil starting to fall apart. That ultimately leads into the Born Again storyline. You see the kind of Daredevil that could actually break.
I think that's
regard.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true, Brett. So we're going to spin out of one female character into another one. Let's talk, Chris, about Martha Washington and all the stories over the years. Miller's done with that, along with Dave Gibson. Gibbons.
The property I most want to see made into the movie, and nobody's even thought about making it for some reason. I love Martha Washington. I mean, this has everything. It has an underdog character. It has a weird political future. It's beautifully drawn. It is probably the most easily accessible of Frank Miller's work. That first volume is perfect. I wouldn't touch a thing on it. That said, as subsequent volumes come out, it's fairly obviously that he's sort of drawing things out. The last volume, Martha Washing Dies, is patheticad. It is not a good comic book at all. But that said,
it takes 37 seconds to read it. It's like 24 pages, and like 15 of it is story.
Yeah, it's not a good comic book. But that first volume is perfect, and the longer you go, the lesser the books get. But, wow, great book. I would love to see this made into a bigger movie or a bigger thing. I would love to see a before Watchmen, a before Give Me Liberty, a before Martha Washington. There are so many fascinating concepts, and he machine guns you with them. It's just wham, 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 wham. Every concept is, there's so much going on. I mean, you have nuclear bombs going off in the States, and it's barely even mentioned. It's mentioned on a freaking map that part of the U.S. is now nuked, and there's revolution going on. Rhode Island is its own freaking country. There's a lot in this book, and there's a lot to enjoy. I love it.
Fantasy cast, who would you have as Martha Washington?
You know, I was thinking, and I'm not typically a fan, especially her previous comic book adaptations, but I do think Halle Berry would make an interesting Martha Washington.
Too good looking.
Rosario Dawson.
Too good looking. Not that I'd complain. Give me your opinion on the book on Martha Washington, the character and the work over the years there, Keith.
Start and finish your exploration of Martha Washington with The Life and Times of Martha Washington Trade. They collected and organized in chronological order according to Martha's life, her entire story into one trade paperback. It is a wonderful book. It is a brick. But it has Give Me Liberty, it has every short story, it has every one-shot. One of the things that's so cool about Martha Washington is that Give Me Liberty had a very specific story to tell. And it was, you know, big government and, you know, the president who was not ready for the job and did about the worst job as he could. He was a liberal gone mad. There's a little bit of that again. And then the meat wars in Brazil, what were they called? The fast food wars. And it had
Burger
a very
Boy,
specific,
is it?
Yeah, it was a very specific thing to tell. And Burger Boy, who very intentionally looked like John Byrne, that character, that image has shown up in a whole bunch of work from that crew. And they told that story. And then instead of trying to tell just stories within that one, a dystopic genre, they told a space story. They told a space alien story. She met Big Guy and Rusty. He and Gibbons just played with whatever came up that they might want to play with. And then he told an ending to the story. And, you know, it's a wonderful read. It's so disjointed because he played with so many different styles over the course of working on this character for, you know, about 10 years in very small bits at a time. I love the character. I love who she was and who she developed into and the whole arc of her life. It's just a fascinating character study and so cool that they have a start and end to the story.
Well put, Keith. Brett?
I'm going to go off on, and sort of agree with Chris a little more. In this case, I love Give Me Liberty, and I love Martha Washington Goes to War. I just really, by the time I got to Saves the World, I actually felt like Saves the World was a little too different for my taste. And I was really hoping, as I was reading through everything, that by the time I got to Martha Washington Dies, I was really hoping that she actually wouldn't reference Saves the World, really, so that I could kind of say, it's Give Me Liberty, goes to war, and dies, and that's the storyline. And I could kind of leave that part out of it. Now, I agree with Chris, because I don't actually think Martha Washington Dies is that good a book, either. And so for me, it's an unsatisfying end, because I thought that it started out in such a high, you know, in so many ways, and then it just kind of meandered off. So I was kind of disappointed, but those first two collections, I absolutely love them. And again, more of that absolute power corrupts absolutely with the government and that kind of character. So a lot of Frank Miller themes really show up in this.
But you know what, Brad, I'm going to talk about something here. I'll get your opinion on this, because, of course, Frank Miller is being accused of the misogyny. And anybody who's seen some of his works, there certainly appears to be evidence of hatred of women in there. And yet he's most well-known to some degrees for creating and developing and giving us a strong female or well-known character in Elektra. And certainly, I think, even more so in Martha Washington, a fully fleshed-out female strong lead character. So where does that kind of rank and put your point of views on those other accusations for you?
To be frank, I actually think that he works really hard.
Or to be Miller.
Huh?
To be frank.
Okay. All right there.
Hey-o.
Keith got it.
There you go. But it's one of those cases where it almost strikes me that he understands the criticism, and he works so damn hard to create female characters. It doesn't actually solve the problem of the misogyny, because it shows up in other characters along the way. But he works really hard to try to make female characters that kick a lot of ass. And maybe it's trying to push back too far the other way. I mean, I do enjoy Martha Washington, no question about it. But I think that the misogyny is still there.
It's still a fair accusation, in your opinion.
Yeah.
How about you, Keith? Where do you come out on that one?
I think hatred of women is too strong. I think it's, and there are moments in Martha Washington, it's not about weakening the character. And it's not about him not being able to write women or anything like that. I think Martha Washington is a fully realized character. It's that Martha Washington still ends up in places in the story where she waits for a guy to tell her what's supposed to happen next. And that's really what I see over and over in his work. It's not, I mean, hatred is way too strong.
It's, you're right, it is, yeah.
It's really that.
It probably is too strong, but that is the actual definition of misogyny, though.
Yeah, and maybe better to say sexism then, or his view of male female relations is narrow. I mean maybe misogyny is too strong a term. I think ultimately these are fully realized characters. Martha Washington is a really great character that occasionally, in the structure of his stories, stops and asks a guy what she's supposed to be doing. You know, it happens a few times. It happens in Give Me Liberty, and it happens in later books as well.
Okay,
but Chris may not agree with me. I'm saying a little bit of head shaking.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, I'm to tell you the truth. Give Me Liberty and the Martha Washington saga is so different than anything else Frank Miller does, that I actually had never really stopped to consider this aspect to the work. Misogyny is definitely very pronounced throughout the rest of his work, but I never stopped to actually consider Martha Washington, and unfortunately I don't really have an opinion. I'm going to have to think about this. Ask me next podcast, I'll probably know then.
We're not. We'll be Frank Millered out. Chris, I'm going to get your thoughts on this then, if you have an opinion, because you did mention the kind of the political overtones of this, and Brett has as well. Let's talk a little bit about the political overtones of Martha Washington from your perspective.
I can't believe this is the same man that called the Wall Street protesters rapists, which, by the way, that quote, I don't even understand where he gets the rapist aspect of it. But really, Martha Washington is those protesters. She was born in the ghetto, in the projects. I think this is part of the disconnect with me, with the recent Frank Miller work, is that I don't understand my perceptions of the man, what I thought I knew about Frank Miller from his work, which turns out I probably don't know as much as I thought I did. I read a lot into stuff that he wrote that now seems totally, like I totally misread it. And the man I know him to be now, Martha Washington, is probably the most interesting of his work when you look at his politics.
Either one of you two, Brett, Keith, either one of you two have any thoughts on that as well? Brett or Keith, you're throwing up your hand there.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the character of the president in Martha Washington, he is a conservative's view of the worst liberal that could possibly get in charge. And he destroys the world. I don't know how much, in hindsight, I don't know how much clearer it can be. It's a liberal who starts a radical environmental program, who starts a radical health program, who then leads the country into fracturing off, starts a war in South America. Frank Miller was raised with the specter of the liberals starting a war in a foreign land because they're telling you how you should live. Vietnam was a liberal's war. It was not a conservative war. And that's, his upbringing. That's the world he lived in. That's what Martha Washington is. It's about the regular people who want to just live their life, but people keep telling them how they should live. It's a conservative's view of liberalism gone amok.
All right, let's, spin out of that into, because we're talking politics, and I did that on purpose, because then we could spin out of that onto talking about Holy Terror, his most recent work. I'm going to give you a quote on this. This is something he said, and this is not regarding a character in the book. This is regarding his work and what he's done with Holy Terror. And this is his quote about himself and the backlash that he received from this book. And he said, community approval isn't for a hero anyways. He told one magazine last year, it's the motive for a politician. A hero does the right thing because it's the right thing. What do you guys think? Chris, let's go to you. Give us some thoughts on Holy Terror.
This has to be the strangest book I have ever read because, I mean, from everything we've said previous, we all have generally positive attitudes towards Frank Miller. And this book is so incredibly bad that you wonder if it
I'm
was
not
created
sure
by the same
if you,
man.
If you look back on that, Chris, I'm not so sure about that. I think we have incredibly inconsistent views on him, wildly skewing from project to project. I don't think positive is at all the way I would put it.
Okay. For me personally, I'd say my feelings toward him up to this point have been generally positive. There are low points. There are works of Frank Miller's I just don't get that weren't written for me. I don't particularly enjoy it. But on a whole, the highs outweigh the lows for me personally. Then you come to Holy Terror, where I look at a book and think, there is absolutely no way that I can see anybody liking this. It was a Batman story that DC didn't want to publish, so he translated it into another character called the Fixer. And then he put it out independently. I gotta wonder what that meeting at Dark Horse was like when Dark Horse was going, we make a lot of money off of Sin City Trade. Frank wants to put this out, but he wants to put this out. What? And Michael Richardson probably had to look at it and tell Frank Miller no. That's how bad this book is. I mean, they would have had to risk threatening their income stream just not to publish this god-awful book. I hate it, and I don't see how anyone can like it.
All right. Not holding back. That's good. Here's a couple quotes regarding this book. Based on what you said here, Chris, you mentioned how it was a Batman book. As he said, it was Batman versus Al-Qaeda, a title in the vein of World War II propaganda comics. He said, but once I saw the way the story was heading, I realized that it was far too extreme to make a Batman comic. DC and I agreed. It now stars a new vigilante called The Fixer, who has none of Batman's qualms about lethal weaponry. While the book was a response to 9/11, he denies that making it was therapeutic, telling us, I don't work that way. He did say, though, regarding superhero characters and their taking on real-life villains, Superman punched out Hitler, so did Captain America. That's one of the things they're there for. Brett, give us some thoughts.
Based on that thought, I mean, Superman punched out Hitler, or Captain America did, and stuff, and it would have been different if Batman was punching out Bin Laden, or the Fixer was going after Bin Laden, because it's that overall figure of evil who is an actual man. The biggest problem that I have is that this is not an actual man. This is a concept. It's like the Fixer is fighting Muslims. The Fixer is fighting characters who wear religious robes of different religions, Eastern religions in that kind of case. And that's my biggest problem, because you can fight an overall evil, but it's really hard to kind of fight a religion in that case. And that's kind of where it comes off to me. I mean, I'm really glad this is not a Batman story, because it would taint his Batman legacy even worse than it is, and I think ultimately it's an atrocity as far as this collection, and it is the one thing that really made me want to do this podcast, because it made me want to go back and read all of the Frank Miller books, because and I'm glad that it was the first Sin City book that I read that was the first one back in, because that book is so good that it at least gave me that good Frank Miller to go alongside this horrible Frank Miller.
Here's a quote. Keith, listen to this quote and then give me your thoughts on the quote and the book. Propaganda has gotten a bad name. Something's called propaganda only when the reader disagrees with it. If they agree, it's called relevant. An artist expressing a point of view, whatever the medium, whatever the story's intent, that's propaganda, and it's relevant, according to Frank Miller. Keith, how about according to you?
I think that, propaganda is meant to motivate and convey. I get where he's coming from, that it's only propaganda if it's unpopular. But ultimately I reject it, because he calls it propaganda himself. And two, it really, yes, Captain America punches out Hitler on the cover of his first appearance, but I don't think that that's what this book is. This book is Superman versus the Japators from the Fleischer Supermans. And it's an embarrassment, because I think the moment for this book was probably within about a year of 9/11, and you would still be a little embarrassed that it had happened. There was a moment where that kind of anger needed an outlet, and then nuance comes in as time goes on. And it would have been kind of ignored and maybe a little embarrassing, but would have been rolled into, well, we all went crazy for a while. We all got angry. We all lost focus and lost perspective for a while. But having taken that much longer, having come out in 2011 instead of 2002, we have the perspective. We know that what he's doing is ridiculous. We know that what he's doing is hateful. And he's doing it to make you angry because he wants people to fight about it. And he was upfront with that too. He wanted this to be controversial. I love that it really wasn't. I love that people dismissed this book so quickly. That there was no one left to argue in favor of this book. And that's fantastic.
Well, you know what? Maybe some people could have if the book itself was actually of higher quality as well. And you don't leave that out. The art outside of the first six pages, of course, no Lynn Varley here, right, Brett?
Absolutely right. Yeah, it's one of those things that I noticed with reading the four pages of Xerxes, is that we talked about how beautiful 300 was, but the four pages that appeared in the Dark Horse Presents of Xerxes are ugly, I think. It's that Sin City, like, late Sin City black and white, but without the color, it just loses all of its energy, and that's certainly something that Holy Terror lacks.
Yeah, first six pages I think are some really nice artwork, and then it just goes to hell. I mean, it doesn't jump off a cliff. I mean, it falls off the whole entire planet. It's just awful. Bad art, bad dialogue, bad characterizations, bad storytelling. So forget about the content. That's offensive. But the book itself is just not a good book. Wouldn't you say, Keith?
Absolutely. And I went back and checked. Brett and I both picked Holy Terror as the worst graphic novel or single story of 2011, and both Chris and Mo shortlisted it. It was Mo just had something that bugged him way more, but it was bottom of the pile for sure.
I'm picking it for 2012 as well
because he had to reread it.
If they get the soft cover out in time,
it's
really bad, really really bad. But we're not going to go out talking about his work with Batman, and you have to say in the history of comic books, even more so, I think, than his work with Daredevil. If there's one book or one character which he's more closely associated with, that would be Batman, wouldn't you guys say?
Yep,
potentially.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I mean, I think that Batman, as we look at the, I believe, I think we'll probably limit this to four projects or maybe four in the one issue. It is the absolute pinnacle and the absolute worst of some of his work.
It really is. Well, Keith, why don't you jump into the four?
Well, we've got four, and they're spread over 25 years. We have year one. We have the Dark Knight. We have the Dark Knight Strikes Again. Or sorry, Dark Knight Returns, to be precise. And then Dark Knight Strikes Again. And then All-Star Batman and Robin. Radically different works, like astoundingly different.
Oh, and don't forget Spawn Batman.
And Spawn Batman and Santa Claus One Dead or Alive. one of my most treasured collections is the leather-bound Frank Miller's Batman, I believe it's called. I believe it's called Frank Miller's Complete Batman, but then, you know, there's other stuff that's on it. And, like, year one is, you know, he's still the Batman origin. It's not worth telling another origin of Batman, unless you want to change the odd detail and maybe not make Catwoman a prostitute. That's really the only reason to dip back into Batman's origin. And the Dark Knight Returns is the pinnacle of the final Batman story. You know, we keep hoping against hope that, you know, that they'll do a film adaptation. It almost happened in the 90s. It almost happened with Clint Eastwood at one point. And it is the dream that would be the way to take a big departure from Chris Nolan and do Dark Knight Returns. The Dark Knight Strikes Again is, I need to get back into it. I want to have another solid read of it. It was so disappointing though. Like so much time had passed, his viewpoint had changed, and he didn't have as much to say as he did with Dark Knight Returns. You know, at that time, you know, at the time Dark Knight Returns came along, people were writing the final stories of the superhero genre. They thought they were wrapping it up. They thought they were closing out the genre. You know, works like The Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns and, you know, the unpublished Alan Moore Twilight of the Gods, or Twilight of the Superheroes, sorry, would have, you know, they were meant as the end of superhero comics. And then the superhero comics didn't end. So, how do you tell another story after you're told what's intended to be the final Batman story? It was just never going to work. And I don't know what you say about his run on the goddamn Batman. it is one of the we talk about memes that won't go away. I'm the goddamn Batman.
This is goddamn Batmobile.
That's right. There's a meme.
And I don't need any goddamn woman.
And I laughed.
Goddamn to him.
And I laughed so hard when there was all that controversy about Catwoman number one and the line at the end and the costume stay on, because not only did that line not surprise me, it didn't surprise me because it's almost word for word in All-Star Batman and Robin when
the masks
stay
on.
Yeah, and the masks stay on. Is in All-Star Batman and Robin. Like, I was just,
that was less offensive because he was boning Black Canary.
That's right. This is a book that showed up on my Lucian's pull list as unfinished work. It's not even entirely collected. I think there's 8 issues ever came out and 7 of them are collected, something like that.
I thought it was 10 that came out, but
10 and the first the trade paperback features 9.
Yeah, I knew it was only one issue that wasn't collected.
Of course, there's an uncensored. I don't know. There's an uncensored version of 10 out there, with
yep, there is.
Yes, some incredibly some language. This is just amazing from these characters' mouths. 15-year-old Batgirl dropping F-bombs and characters being called the C-word. Every female character being called the C-word and everything. Just wow. Here's a couple quotes I'm going to give. I got a few on this one, and then we'll jump over to Chris. But you can't have virtue without sin. What I'm after is having my characters' virtues defined by how they operate in a very sinful environment. That's how you test people. Surprisingly, not about Sin City, about Batman, that particular quote. He also said about him, you do Batman right and he's going to be popular, said Miller. He's a great character. Well, I was once asked by somebody if writing Batman was like holding a Ming vase or something. I said, no, it's like holding a big ass diamond that he can't break. You can throw him against the ceiling, against the floor, anywhere, and you just can't break Batman. Well, he might have with Batman and Robin, but he, year one, I still think is the best Batman story ever told. Chris, thoughts on his work with Batman?
Sure. Batman in 1 year, year one, or as it should be called, how to do an origin. I don't think it's ever been done better. I don't think it'll ever will be done better. This book will be reprinted till the end of time. It is the perfect Batman story. That's really all I got to say about that one. Dark Knight Returns. The perfect end to the perfect beginning. Between these two books, you have a complete story arc. Absolutely fabulous. But moving on to the Dark Knight, I'm sorry, what is the second Dark Knight called officially?
Strikes Again.
It's funny because one of the quotes that he has about it is, can lightning strike twice? Yeah, it wasn't the most clever one he came
up
with.
Well, no lightning struck twice on this one. But as Keith said, how do you do a story after the last Batman story? The story had finished. I think it was a mistake to go back. Frank should have said something. DC probably should have said something. But it didn't work. There are aspects of the book that I actually love. The concept of Plastic Man, actually this is my favorite way of describing Plastic Man. He's a nuclear bomb of crazy. I like the Robin turning into more Catwoman. Some of the characters are interesting, but on a whole, it doesn't hold. There's no gel there. It doesn't take, and I was disappointed by it. Is it a bad book? No, but is it a good book? Probably not either. It doesn't live up. It was disappointing. Moving along, I think it's worth mentioning the Batman Spawn crossover did take place in between Dark Knight and Dark Knight Strikes Back, With predictable results, you have the same problem as in Strikes Back, is that it really doesn't hold. There's no story to tell there, although it does have the first appearance of Muck Boy, which between me, Brett, and Mo, was a major character for us to joke about. Moving on to All-Star Batman, I actually like the dialogue a lot in this book. It's a completely different take on Batman and the Batman characters than we've ever seen before.
Completely different goddamn take.
Yes, goddamn take. And I like that take. I actually fault this book is a hard read. It's really hard, and I think that comes...
I'm making faces at you, Chris, because I just can't believe what you're in the middle of saying.
Yeah. I think the book falls apart in the fact that Jim Lee and Frank Miller have very divergent styles, and I don't think they ever gelled together well creatively. I think if you had another artist on this, it would be a very different book. I think it could be good, but as it stands, it's not. It's terrible, in fact, the way it stands.
It's an offensive book. It's as misogynistic piece of work as has ever been put to pen to paper published through DC. It's something else. I mean, come on. And Jim Lee's probably as much to blame for this piece of crap and the attitudes and what happens in it as Frank Miller, for absolutely sure, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an exaggeration of the Batman, which is what I kind of liked about it. It was exaggerating. It was highlighting all the things that are in a regular Batman comic, but turned up till 10. And I like that. I just don't think it was pulled off successfully.
He said he wanted to make books fun again because they'd gotten to be too many grim and gritty characters, and he was trying to make it fun again. He was trying to make it fun by making fun of the grim and gritty. Is that what he's trying to do here, Brett? I mean, I don't know. Do you want any quotes here, Brett, or should I? Do you just want to weigh in? I got a few good ones.
Okay, well, if you want to read them off, then you can read them off, and then I'll just go off.
All right, well, one of the things he said was, and I'm going to save one of these because I want to get a different take on it, but I got a few good ones here. He said, I realized I was about to turn 30, and Batman was permanently 29, and I'll be damned if I was older than Batman. So that's how it's part of his inspiration for that, for The Dark Knight Returns that came about. He also said, those of us who wanted to test the boundaries of what superhero comic book could do, unfortunately broke those boundaries, and the results would be not all being very good. We pushed against the old walls, and they fell, but nothing much has been built up to replace them. And now the roof is leaking, and the sewer's backing up. So basically, he wishes he hadn't made Grim and Gritty so damn popular. Goddamn popular. Wonder what I want to bring back to superheroes with this project is a sense of play. Things have gotten so dreary. The heroes have gotten so ugly that even their muscles have muscles. So instead he had a Batman that beat on Robin so that we would get that, wouldn't have that problem anymore. incredible. It's a step backwards, and I'll have to face that. At the very least, it's not a repetition of the first Dark Knight. Regarding Dark Knight Strikes. What is it again? Strikes Again?
Strikes Again.
Yeah. It uses the first one as a springboard to a new story. As you kept on talking about how do you do a story after the last Batman, it says used as a springboard. Dark Knight was ripping down a deconstruction of the hero, as many said, which I don't believe it was. This is much more of a building up. So he didn't think he was breaking down a hero. He didn't think what he's being accused of he was doing there. But he says here he's trying to build him back up. I've seen all these characters of my childhood fall into disarray. They've become neither fish nor fowl. Those of us who wanted to test the boundaries of what a superhero could be, unfortunately, I think I've already said that part. So he also said he was having a very good time doing the book. Brett, that's enough quotes for me for now. I got a couple more, but why don't you give your thoughts?
I don't even know where to start when it comes to Frank Miller and Batman, because the dichotomy is so extreme. The thing is that one thing that I had read and I read it after I read the All-Star Batman and Robin, is that he was Dark Knight Batman. So that it wasn't going to grow up to be the Batman that we all know and love, but it was going to grow up to be the douchebag in The Dark Knight Returns. And I have trouble with that.
That explains things to some degree.
Wait, so is All-Star Batman and Robin before Dark Knight?
Yes.
Interesting.
From what I understand. And it throws a different take on the actual entire series. I still don't like it. And for me, now keep in mind, I'm not a fan of any of the All-Star books. I think they're both awful. But the ultimate thing is that it just goes along. It's so tough. I'm gonna go back because I want to talk about something happy for a bit. The only thing that I struggle with The Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One is which one I like more. I totally agree that Batman Year One is the perfect Batman story, and I would happily hand that book to anybody to read because it's that strong a book. The Dark Knight Returns is just such a great version, you know, and an ending, like you say. It's such a shame that he felt that he had to revisit the Dark Knight universe because...
Brett, just before you say it, I'm just going to say this is one last quote, and maybe this will influence what you're about to say about him revisiting. He said, when I was doing the first Dark Knight, Bruce was a very self-destructive, tortured man. He was endlessly angry. When this story begins, 3 years have passed, and he will look younger than he did in the first series. So it takes place 3 years later, but he looks younger. Great. He will be strangely happy and at peace. He will be much more powerful figure and be tested. Every hero has to be tested, for that's how they're defined. It all comes down to what is a hero. For all the flash and glamour of superheroes and their funky costumes and their powers, they hardly have to be heroic. I'm really sick of the hero being the guy who wins to get the medal at the end. It always makes me a little ill because it gets to the heart of the corrupt premise, crime does not pay. That should not be the reason to not commit crimes. Of course they pay. Crime is wrong should be the message. Does that at all affect what you're about to say regarding him returning to the Dark Knight?
No, because what I'm originally going to talk about is the concept that when he returned to the Dark Knight universe, it was in Spawn Batman.
Good point.
Because that is part of that universe as well. And so it's one of those cases where things return to the Dark Knight universe is so spotty by itself. But the number one thing that I really want to touch on is because when I read and talked about his Daredevil, I talked about how hungry he was. And to me, The Dark Knight Strikes Again and All-Star Batman and Robin are a perfect example of an artist who is not hungry and who feels that they have done everything they could ever want in comic books, perhaps, and that they're almost a glutton for, you know, in the industry. Because Frank Miller just seems to be writing on his own steam. Like, whatever Frank Miller writes, he feels like somebody is going to enjoy. And those stories are just, they're bloated and they're over the top. What made Daredevil so good was Hell's Kitchen and Matt Murdock. What makes Dark Knight Strikes Again so bad is the fact that everybody's in a costume. It's all costumes. It's almost like Frank Miller has gone completely in the opposite direction. And that is one of the things that most of all with that book. It's a hard read. It's not a fun read. And it's just, to me, it's depressing because I love Frank Miller's Batman. I mean, how many artists out there, how many creators are so heavily associated with, you know, not one, but two characters? I mean, here's a
three,
guy who...
if you include Elektra.
Well, yeah, but I mean, when you talk about Daredevil and Batman, I mean, you automatically come back to Frank Miller. And that's amazing to think that there's a creator out there who can have that kind of influence on two major comic book characters.
First guy I think of for both characters.
Absolutely.
You know, and so, Peter David for the Hulk, right?
Yeah. And, you know, you can think of Walt Simonson for Thor and stuff like that. But
yeah.
It's just that it's such a shame that the rest of it is so bad, that the rest of his Batman is just so weak.
Was that Catwoman there? Was she giving her thoughts?
Yeah.
What's Selina think about what's going on?
Well, other than the fact that it's a boy, you know. It's that,
I know.
That year one is perfect.
Yes.
It really is, though. It really is. All right. Any final thoughts on his work with Batman?
I'm pretty sure that there was some swastikas in there somewhere. Because if you count up the number of books that have swastikas of Frank Miller's, it's over the top.
His swastika was when was, I think, issue 7 or 8 of All-Star Batman, when after Joker rapes and kills a woman, beats her to death, he walks out and tells a topless woman with swastikas painted over her nipples, over her wildly huge breasts, to dispose of the body. And she says, she does a yes, Hail Hitler thing. Not offensive at all, right?
I just don't know where it comes from.
You know what, Keith, you're right. Yeah, he doesn't hate women. Sexist only.
I believe he had the same gag in Martha Washington. Didn't the nurses have swastikas over their breasts? No, the Nazi, Martha Washington goes to space. The Nazi chicks had a.
And I thought there was something in Sin City as well, but.
Probably.
Well,
probably.
No, I know there was tons of swastikas there, but it's just, if I could ask him one question, it's like, why is this a recurring image within almost all of your work?
Okay, well, let's go out here. I'm going to do my plugs first here. I'm Mo, M-O, at We Talk Podcasts. Mo _ We Talk, M-O, no E in my name. And please visit Comic Off City for all the news we didn't give you. The site is awesome. You can follow them on Twitter as well, at Comic Off City. And also listen to the Comic Podcast Network and check out other good stuff over there. But I just got to say my final thoughts on Miller. I have no idea. After all this, I thought I'd understand him better and have a final thoughts and have something wrapped up. And I feel like in some ways, I know him better and less than ever. Because talk about a guy who just you can't get a handle on from moment to moment and series to series. Brett, I'm going to throw to you, but first off, my final quote, and we'll see if this at all influences your final thoughts. He says, though Holy Terror and 300 have led some to brand him a conservative, he says he wouldn't redo anything about The Dark Knight Returns, which depicted Ronald Reagan as a witless boob and Superman as a uber-patriotic fascist. Final thoughts, Brett.
All right. Well, I'll start off with the business. Brett _ We Talk on Twitter. That's Brett. Brett at WeTalkPodcast.com. For those of you who have possibly missed the WeViews, I reviewed the Prophet trade paperback, which is excellent, by the way. And one thing that I will quickly say is I'm going to thank Rob Liefeld for not touching it. But the other thing that I'm going to talk about probably is Rocketeer. That'll go up on Comicosity in the next day or so. But, you know, as far as Frank Miller, the work that Frank Miller has done that is great is amazingly great. The work that he has done that is bad is horrifically bad. And I think that the concept of not wanting to redo the characters and stuff like that, you know, one of the things that I love about The Dark Knight Returns is I love the character of Superman. I love that take because it's just such a different imagining of Superman as we would normally look at him. So I wouldn't want him to change that by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, in that case, his political viewpoints, they don't bother me because the story works very well. It's when his political viewpoints start overwhelming the actual characters that he's trying to tell that I think he runs into trouble. But Frank Miller is a great artist. When he's hungry, he is one of the best that there's ever been. he's just not hungry enough.
Chris, your turn, man.
All right. I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com. Chris underscore WeTalk on Twitter. Please join me on Twitter. I'm in the striking distance of Keith. I would like to be the second most popular on Twitter. So please give me a follow.
Anything on Frank?
No final thoughts on Frank Miller?
You know what? I'm leaving it out there just because I think we've all come to the conclusion that Frank Miller needs to be undecided still. I don't think any of us are willing to write him off completely, yet his most recent work has scared the bejesus out of us on how bad it actually could be. But we're not willing to write him off because we still see flashes of brilliance.
And how about you, Keith?
All right, you can email me, Keith, at WeTalkPodcast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, CubReporterK, and I want to stay ahead of Chris, so please make sure to follow me. And I think that what we came to with Frank Miller is the challenge of today's world, where we have access to so much information about artists besides their art. I'm a huge fan of Jack Kerouac. The more I read about Jack Kerouac, I realized just how horrible a human being he was. But his art is his art. And with Frank Miller, every time I hear him speak, and it's the Alan Moore thing, every time I hear him speak, I want to hear him less because I want to maintain that distance between the work that I love so much and the individual that I mean, in Frank Miller's case, lately I found repulsive. I want to enjoy Daredevil for what it is and what he was saying. And as I realized going through a lot of this material, I put my own lens, I put my own values on what he was saying, and actually found I didn't find the message that he might have wanted. I found the message that was there for me. The meaning of a story is halfway between the book and my eyes. It's not in the book itself. I'll be there for the next Frank Miller piece.
What book did this Kerouac guy write? What comic book? Was he on Superman for a while?
He wrote DC Comics Presents in the 1970s. That's
right. It does sound to me, guys, like we're going to have to do a part two on Frank Miller in about 25 years, and maybe then we'll have all decided on him. Everybody up for it?
Yeah, podcast, and you know what that one could be called? 25 to life.
So we'll be doing this podcast. We've all committed to at least 25-year run, 25 more years, since we're 1 year in, just over 1 year in now.
So that should be about 8 comic books, so it should be easy to read, and they won't be collected, none of them will have finished.
Exactly. But I hope everybody enjoyed listening to this as much as we enjoyed doing it. We've been talking about it since probably like the second episode, first episode. I mean, we've talked about this for a long time. Everybody put I want to thank the guys for all their hard work. Everybody put a lot of hard work into this. Self-congratulations, because I think you guys did an awesome job tonight. And thanks for carrying me through another one. This was, I hope everybody really, really enjoys it. It was a lot of fun. So thank you very, very much. And I think we are officially, Brett, something
nope.
to add?
No, nope. We don't want to forget about the Comics Podcast Network that we are a member of.
I mentioned it at
when
I did my plug.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that one, then. I just don't
That's
listen
all
to
right. it. No, nobody does. Anyways, we're OUT.
This is Sparta! 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 This is Sparta!